A burst of air. She had been holding her breath and didn't realize it.
"It's a perfect horse, except it's just the head," Ayla said.
"That's why the seventh cave is called Horsehead Rock," the old man said. He was just behind her. Ayla stared at the image, feeling a sense of awe and wonder, and reached out to touch the stone, not even questioning whether she should have. She was drawn to it. She held her hand on the side of the jaw, just where she would have touched a living horse, and after a time the cold stone seemed to warm, as though it wanted to be alive and come out of the stone wall. She took her hand away, and then put it back. The rock's surface still held some warmth, but then it cooled again, and she realized that the first had continued to hum while she touched the stone, but had stopped when she let go.
"Who made it?" Ayla asked.
"No one knows," said the first.
She had come in after Zelandani of the Seventh Cave.
"It was made so long ago, no one remembers. One of the ancients, of course, but we have no legend or history to tell us who."
"Perhaps the same carver who made the mother of Elder Hearth," said the Zelandani of the Second Cave. "What makes you think so?" asked the old man. "They are entirely different images. One is a woman holding a bison horn in her hand. The other is the head of a horse."
"I have studied both carvings. There seems to be a similarity of technique," she said. "Notice how carefully the nose and the mouth and the shape of the jaw of this horse are made. When you go there, look at the hips on the mother, the shape of the belly. I've seen women who look just like that, especially those who have had children. Like this horse, the carving of the woman that represents Donnie in the cave at Elder Hearth is very true to life."
"That's very perceptive," said the one who was first. "When we go to Elder Hearth, we'll do as you suggest, and look closely."
They stood quietly, staring at the horse for a while. Then the first said,
"We should go. There are some other things in here, but we can look at them later. I wanted Ayla to see the horse head before we got involved with visiting and such."
"I'm glad you did," Ayla said. "I didn't know carvings in stone could look so real."
Chapter 3 "There you are," Kimmeran said, getting up from a stone seat on the ledge in front of the shelter of the seventh cave to greet Ayla and Jandalar, who had just climbed up the path. Wolf followed behind them, and Janela was awake and propped up on Ayla's hip.
"We knew you had come, and then no one knew where you were."
Jandalar's old friend Kimmeran, the leader of Elder Hearth, the second cave of the Zelandanyi, had been waiting for him. The very tall, light-haired man bore a superficial resemblance to 6'6" Jandalar with his pale yellow hair. Though many men were tall, over 6 feet, both Jandalar and Kimmeran had towered over their other age-mates at their puberty rites. They were drawn to each other and quickly became friends. Kimmeran was also the brother of the Zelandani of the Second Cave and the uncle of Jondakam, but more like a brother. His sister was quite a bit older, and she had raised him after their mother died, along with her own son and daughter. Her mate had also passed on to the next world, and not long afterwards she began training for the Zelandania.
"The first wanted Ayla to see your horse head, and then we needed to get our horses settled,"
Jandalar said.
"They are going to love your field. The grass is so green and rich," Ayla added.
"We call it Sweet Valley. The little grass river runs through the middle of it, and the floodplain has widened into a large field. It can get marshy in spring from snow melt, and when the rains come in fall. But in summer, when everything else is dried out, that field stays fresh and green," Kimmeran said, as they continued walking toward the living space beneath the overhanging upper shelf. "It attracts a nice procession of grazers through here all summer long, and makes hunting easy. Either the second or the seventh cave always has someone watching."
They approached more people.
You remember Serjanar, the leader of the Seventh Cave, don't you?
Kimaran said to the visiting couple, indicating a middle-aged, dark-haired man who had been standing back, eyeing the wolf warily, and letting the younger leader greet his friends.
Yes, of course, Jandalar said, noting his apprehension and thinking that this visit might be a good time to help people get more comfortable around Wolf. I remember when Serjanar used to come to talk to Marthona when he was first chosen as leader of the Seventh. You have met Ayla, I believe.
I was one of the many to whom she was introduced last year when you first arrived, but I haven't had a chance to greet her personally, Serjanar said.
He held out both hands, palms up.
In the name of Dani, I welcome you to the Seventh Cave of the Zelindanyi, Ayla of the Ninth Cave. I know you have many other names and ties, some quite unusual, but I will admit I don't remember them.
Ayla grasped both of his hands in hers.
I am Ayla of the Ninth Cave of the Zelindanyi, she began. Acolyte to Zelindani of the Ninth Cave, first among those who serve.
Then she hesitated, wondering how many of Jandalar's ties to mention. At the matrimonial ceremony last summer, all of Jandalar's names and ties were added to hers, and it made for a very long recitation, but it was only during the most formal of ceremonies that the whole list was required. Since this was her official meeting of the leader of the Seventh Cave, she wanted to make the introduction formal, but not go on and on. She decided to cite the closest of his ties and continue with her own, including her previous ties. She finished with the appellations that had been added in a more light-hearted vein, but that she liked to use.
Friend of the horses, Winnie, Racer, and Gray, and the four-legged hunter, Wolf. In the name of the great mother of all, I greet you, Serjanar, leader of the Seventh Cave of the Zelindanyi, and I would like to thank you for inviting us to Horsehead's Rock.
She is definitely not a Zelindanyi, Serjanar thought, as he heard her speak. She may have Jandalar's names and ties, but she's a foreigner with foreign customs, especially about animals. As he dropped her hands, he eyed the wolf who had come closer. Ayla saw his uneasiness around the big carnivore. She had noticed that Kimaran was not particularly comfortable near the animal either, though he had been introduced to Wolf last year shortly after they arrived, and he had seen him several times. Neither of the leaders was accustomed to seeing a hunting meat-eater moving so easily among people. Her thoughts were similar to Jandalar's. This might be a good time to get them more accustomed to Wolf. The people of the Seventh Cave were noticing that the couple everyone talked about from the Ninth Cave had arrived, and more people were coming to see the woman with the wolf. All the nearby caves had known within a day when Jandalar returned from his 5-year-long journey the summer before. Arriving on horseback with a foreign woman guaranteed it. They had met people from most of the nearby caves at the Ninth Cave when they came to visit, or at the last summer meeting. But this was the first time they had paid a visit to the Seventh or the Second Cave. Ayla and Jandalar had planned to go the previous fall, but never quite made it. It wasn't that their caves were so far away from each other, but something always seemed to interfere. And then winter was upon them, and Ayla was getting along in her pregnancy. All the delayed expectation had made their visit an occasion, especially since the first had decided to have a meeting here with the local Zelindania at the same time.
Whoever carved the horse head in the cave below must have known horses. It is very well made, Ayla said.
I always thought so, but it is nice to hear it from someone who knows horses as well as you do, Serjanar said.
Wolf was sitting back on his haunches with his tongue hanging out of the side of his mouth, eyeing the man, his bent ear giving him a cocky, self-satisfied look. Ayla knew he was expecting to be introduced. He had watched her greet the leader of the Seventh Cave, and he had come to expect to be presented to any stranger that she greeted in that way.
I also want to thank you for allowing me to bring Wolf. He's always unhappy if he can't be near me, and now he feels that way about John Ayla, since he loves children so much," Ayla said.
"That wolf loves children?" Serjanar said.
"Wolf didn't grow up with other wolves. He was raised with the Mamutoi children of the lion camp and thinks of people as his pack, and all wolves love the young of their packs," Ayla said. "He saw me greet you, and now he expects to meet you. He has learned to accept anyone that I introduce him to."
Serjanar frowned. "How do you introduce a wolf?" he said. He glanced at Kimmeran and saw him grinning. The younger man was remembering his introduction to Wolf, and though he might still be somewhat nervous around the carnivore, he was rather enjoying the older man's discomfiture. Ayla signaled Wolf to come forward and knelt down to put her arm around him, then reached for Serjanar's hand. He jerked it back.
"He only needs to smell it," Ayla said, "so he becomes familiar with you. It's the way wolves meet each other."
"Did you do this, Kimmeran?" Serjanar said, noticing that most of his cave and their visitors were watching. "Yes, in fact I did. Last summer, when they went to the third cave to hunt before the summer meeting. Afterwards, whenever I saw the wolf at the meeting, I had the feeling that he recognized me, though he ignored me," Kimmeran said. He didn't really want to, but with all the people watching, Serjanar was feeling pressed to comply. He didn't want anyone to think that he was afraid to do what the younger leader had already done. Slowly, tentatively, he stretched out his hand toward the animal. Ayla took it and brought it to the animal's nose. Wolf wrinkled his nose and, with his mouth closed, bared his teeth so that his large carnassial shearing teeth showed, in what Jondalar always thought of as his feeling full of himself grin. But that wasn't how Serjanar saw it. Ayla could feel him shaking and noticed the sour smell of his fear. She knew Wolf did, too.
"Wolf won't hurt you, I promise," Ayla said softly under her breath.
Serjanar gritted his teeth, forcing himself to hold steady while the wolf brought his tooth-filled mouth close to his hand. Wolf sniffed, then licked. "What's he doing?" Serjanar said. "Trying to see what I taste like?"
"No, I think he's trying to calm you, like he would a puppy. Here, touch his head."
She moved his hand away from the sharp teeth and was speaking in a soothing voice.
"Have you ever felt the fur of a living wolf? Do you notice that behind his ears and around his neck, the fur is a little thicker and rougher? He likes being rubbed behind his ears."
When she finally let go, the man moved his hand away and held it in his other hand.
"Now he will recognize you," she said.
She had never seen anyone so afraid of Wolf or more brave in overcoming his fear.
"Have you ever had any experience with wolves before?" she asked.
"Once, when I was very young, I was bitten by a wolf. I don't really remember. My mother told me about it. But I still have the scars," Serjanar said.
"That means the wolf spirit chose you. The wolf is your totem. That's what the people who raised me would say."
She knew totems were not viewed the same way by the Zelandanyi as they were by the clan. Not everyone had one, but they were considered lucky by those who did.
"I was clawed by a cave lion when I was young, when I could count perhaps 5 years. I still have the scars to show for it, and I still dream about it sometimes. It is not easy to live with a powerful totem like a lion or a wolf, but my totem has helped me, taught me many things," Ayla said.
Serjanar was intrigued, almost in spite of himself. "What did you learn from a cave lion?"
"How to face my fears, for one thing," she said. "I think you have learned to do the same. Your wolf totem may have helped you without your knowing it."
"Perhaps. But how would you know if you've been helped by a totem? Has a cave lion spirit really helped you?" Serjanar asked.
"More than once. The four marks that the lion's claw left on my leg, that is a clan totem mark for a cave lion. Usually it is only a man who is given such a strong totem, but they were so clearly clan marks. The leader accepted me, even though I was born to the others. That's their name for people like us. I was very young when I lost my people. If the clan hadn't taken me in and raised me, I would not be alive now,
Ayla explained. Interesting. But you said more than once,
Serjanar reminded her. Another time, after I became a woman and the new young leader forced me to leave, I walked for a long time looking for the others, as my clan mother Isa had told me to do before she died. But when I couldn't find them, and I had to find a place to stay before winter came, my totem sent a pride of lions to make me change my direction, which led me to find a valley where I could survive. It was even my cave lion who led me to Jandalar, Ayla said.
The people who were standing around listening were fascinated with her story. Even Jandalar had never heard her explain her totem in quite that way. One of them spoke out.
And these people who took you in, the ones you call the clan, are they really flatheads? That's your name for them. They call themselves the clan of the cave bear, because they all venerate the spirit of the cave bear. He is the totem of all of them, the clan totem, Ayla said. I think it's time to let these travelers know where they can put down their sleeping rolls and get settled so they can share a meal with us,
said a woman who had just arrived. She was a pleasantly round, attractive woman, with the glint of intelligence and spirit in her eyes. Serjanar smiled with warm affection.
This is my mate, Jevina, of the seventh cave of the Zelindanyi, he said to Ayla. Jevina, this is Ayla of the ninth cave of the Zelindanyi. She has many more names and ties, but I'll let her tell you.
But not now, Jevina said. In the name of the mother, welcome, Ayla of the Ninth Cave. I'm sure you would rather get settled now, rather than recite names and ties.
As they were starting to leave, Serjanar touched Ayla's arm and looked at her, then said quietly,
I sometimes dream of wolves.
She smiled. As they were leaving, a voluptuous young woman with dark brown hair approached, holding two children in her arms, a dark-haired boy and a blonde girl. She smiled at Kimmeran, who lightly brushed her cheek with his, then turned to the visitors.
You met my mate, Belladora, last summer, didn't you? He said, adding in a voice filled with pride, and her son and daughter, the children of my hearth.
Ayla recalled meeting the woman briefly the summer before, though she hadn't had a chance to get to know her. She knew that Belladora had given birth to her two born together at the summer meeting around the time of the first matrimonial, when she and Jandalar were mated. Everyone had been talking about it. That meant the two would soon be able to count 1 year, she thought.
Yes, of course, Jandalar said, bestowing a smile on the woman and her twins.
Then, without really being aware of it, paying closer attention to the attractive young mother, his vivid blue eyes full of appreciation. She smiled back. Kimmeran moved closer and put an arm around her waist. Ayla was adept at reading body language, but she thought anyone could have understood what had just transpired. Jandalar found Belladora attractive and couldn't help showing it, just as she couldn't help responding to him. Jandalar was unaware of his own charisma, didn't even realize he projected it, but Belladora's mate was very aware of it. Without saying a word, Kimmeran had stepped in and made his claim known. Ayla observed the byplay and was so intrigued that even though Jandalar was her mate, she didn't feel any jealousy. She did, however, begin to appreciate the comments she had been hearing about him ever since they had arrived. At a deeper level, she knew that Jandalar was only appreciating. He had no desire to do more than look. There was another side to him,
one that he rarely showed even to her, and then only when they were alone. Jandalar's emotions had always been too strong, his passions too great. All his life he had struggled to control them, and had finally managed only by learning to keep his feelings to himself. It was not easy for him to show the full intensity of his feelings. That was why he never displayed publicly the depth of his love for her. But sometimes, when they were alone, he couldn't control it. It was so powerful it sometimes overwhelmed him. When Ayla turned her head, she noticed Zelandani, who was first, observing her, and understood that she, too, had been aware of the unspoken interactions and was trying to judge her response. Ayla gave her a knowing smile, then turned her attention to her baby, who was squirming in her carrying blanket, trying to find a way to nurse. She approached the handsome young mother who was standing beside Jevina.
"Greetings, Belladora. I am glad to see you, especially with your children," she said. "Jonela has soaked her padding. I brought some extra to replace it. Would you show me where I can change it?"
The woman with a baby on each hip smiled.
"Come with me,"
she said, and the three women started toward the shelter. Belladora had heard people talk about Ayla's unusual accent, but she hadn't really heard her speak before. She was in labor during the matrimonial when Jandalar mated his foreign woman, and she'd had little occasion to talk to Ayla later. She was busy with her own concerns, but now she knew what they meant. Though Ayla spoke Zelandani very well, she just couldn't make some of the sounds exactly right. But Belladora was rather pleased to hear her. She had come from a region far to the south, and though her speech wasn't as unusual as Ayla's, she spoke Zelandani with her own distinctive accent. Ayla smiled when she heard her talk.
"I think you were not born a Zelandani," she said, "just as I was not. My people are known as the Gionadani. We are neighbors of a cave of Zelandani far south of here, where it's much warmer."
Belladora smiled.
"I met Kimmeran when he traveled with his sister on her Danyar tour."
Ayla wondered what a Danyar tour was. Obviously, it had something to do with being a Zelandani, since Danyar was another word for one who served the Great Mother. But Ayla decided she would ask the first later. The fire's lambent flames cast a comforting ruddy glow beyond the confines of the oblong hearth that contained it, and painted a warm dancing light on the limestone walls of the abri. The rock ceiling of the overhanging ledge above the fire reflected the glowing hue down on the scene, giving the people a radiant look of well-being. A delicious communal meal that had taken many people a great deal of time and effort to prepare had been consumed, including a huge haunch of megaceros, roasted on a sturdy spit stretched across large forked branches over that same extended rectangular fire pit. Now the seventh cave of the Zelandani, along with many relatives from the second cave, and their visitors from the ninth and third caves were ready to relax. Beverages had been offered, several varieties of tea, a fermented fruity wine, and the alcoholic brew called Barma, made from birch sap, with additions of wild grains, honey, or various fruits. They had each taken a cup of their favorite drink and were milling about, looking for a place to sit near the welcoming hearth. A heightened feeling of anticipation and delight permeated the group. Visitors always brought a bit of excitement, but the foreign woman with her animals and exotic stories promised to be more stimulating than usual. Ayla and Jandalar were in the midst of a group that included Joharan and Proliva, Serjanar and Jevina, and Kimmeran and Belladora, the leaders of the ninth, seventh, and second caves, and several others, including Lavila and Janita and their mates, Jondakam and Peridol. The leaders were discussing with the people of the seventh cave when the visitors should leave Horsehead Rock and go to Elder Hearth, with jocular asides, in a friendly rivalry with the second cave about where the visitors should stay the longest.
Elder Harth is senior and should be higher ranking and accorded more prestige,
Kimmeran said with a teasing grin,
so we should have them longer.
Does that mean because I'm older than you, I should be accorded more prestige?
Serjanar countered with a telling smile.
I'll remember that.
Ayla had been listening and smiling with the rest, but she had been wanting to ask a question. At a break in the conversation, she finally said,
Now that you have brought up the ages of the caves, there is something I would like to know.
They all turned to look at her.
You have only to ask,
Kimmeran said, with exaggerated courtesy and friendliness that intimated the suggestion of more. He had drunk a few cups of Barma and was noticing how attractive his tall friend's mate was.
Last summer, Manvalar was telling me a little about the counting word names of each cave, but I'm still confused,
Ayla said.
When we went to the summer meeting last year, we stopped overnight at the 29th cave. They live at 3 separate shelters around the big valley, each with a leader and a Zelindani, but they are all called by the same counting word, the 29th. The 2nd cave is closely related to the 7th cave, and you live just across a valley, so why do you have a cave with a different counting word? Why aren't you part of the 2nd cave?
That's one I can't answer. I don't know,
Kimmeran said, then gestured toward the older man.
You'll have to ask the more senior leader. Serjanar?
Serjanar smiled, but pondered the question for a moment.
To be honest, I don't know either. It never occurred to me before, and I don't know of any histories or elder legends that tell about it. There are some that tell stories of the original inhabitants of the region, the first cave of the Zelindanyi, but they have long since disappeared. No one even knows for sure where their shelter was.
You do know that the 2nd cave of the Zelindanyi is the oldest settlement of the Zelindanyi still in existence,
Kimmeran said, his voice slightly slurred.
That's why it's called Elder Harth.
Yes, I knew that,
she said, wondering if he would need the morning-after drink she had concocted for Talut, the Mamutoi leader of the Lion Camp.
I'll tell you what I think, Serjanar said. As the families of the 1st and 2nd caves grew too large for their shelters, some of them, offshoots of both caves as well as new people who had come into the region, moved farther away, taking the next counting words when they established a new cave. By the time the group of people from the 2nd cave who founded our cave decided to move, the next unused counting word was 7. They were mostly young families, some newly mated couples, the children of the 2nd cave, and they wanted to stay close to their relatives, so they moved here, just across Sweet Valley, to make their new home. Even though the 2 caves were so closely related, they were the same as 1 cave. I think they chose a new number because that's the way it was done. So, we became 2 separate caves, Elder Harth, the 2nd cave of the Zelindanyi, and Horsehead Rock, the 7th cave. We are still just different branches of the same family. The 29th is a newer cave. Serjanar continued. When they moved to their new shelters, I suspect they all wanted to keep the same counting word name, because the smaller the counting word, the older the settlement. There's a certain prestige in having a lower counting word, and 29 was rather large already. I suspect none of the people founding the new caves wanted a larger one. They decided to call themselves 3 Rocks, the 29th cave of the Zelindanyi, and then use the names they had already given to the locations to explain the difference. The original settlement is called Reflection Rock, because from certain places you can see yourself in the water below. It is one of the few shelters that face north, and is not quite as easy to keep warm, but it is a remarkable place, and has many other advantages.
It is the south holding of the 29th cave, or sometimes the south holding of three rocks. South face became the north holding, and summer camp became the west holding of the 29th cave. I think their way is more complicated and confusing, but it's their choice.
If the second cave is the oldest, then the next oldest group still in existence must be Two Rivers Rock, the third cave of the Zelandanyi. We stayed there last night,
Ayla said, nodding as she understood more.
That's right, Proliva said, joining in. But there is no fourth cave, is there?
There was a fourth cave, Proliva replied, but no one seems to know what happened to it. There are legends that hint at some catastrophe that struck more than one cave, and the fourth may have disappeared around that time, but no one knows. It's a dark time in the histories, too. Some fighting with the Flatheads is inferred.
The fifth cave, called Old Valley, upstream along the river, is next after the third,
Jondalar said.
We were going to visit them on our way to the summer meeting last year, but they had already left, remember?
Ayla nodded.
They have several shelters on both sides of Short River Valley, some for living, some for storage, but they don't give them separate counting words. All of Old Valley is the fifth cave.
The sixth cave has disappeared, too, Serjanar continued. There are different stories about what happened to it. Most people think illness reduced their numbers. Others believe there was a difference of opinion between factions. In any case, the histories indicate that the people who had once been the sixth cave joined up with other caves. So, we, the seventh cave, are next. There is no eighth cave either. So your cave, the ninth, comes after ours.
There was a moment of silence while the information was absorbed. Then, changing the subject, Jondakam asked Jondalar if he would look at the spear thrower he had made, and Lavila told her older sister Proliva that she was thinking about going to the ninth cave to have her baby, which elicited a smile. People started having private conversations and soon split up into other groups. Jondakam was not the only one who wanted to ask questions about the spear thrower, especially after learning about the lion hunt the day before. Jondalar had developed the hunting weapon while he lived with Ayla in her eastern valley, and had demonstrated it shortly after he had returned to his home the previous summer. He had held further exhibitions at the summer meeting. Earlier in the afternoon, when Jondalar was waiting for Ayla to visit Horsehead Cave, several had practiced casting spears with throwers they had made, patterned after the ones they had seen him use, while Jondalar gave them instructions and advice. Now a group of people, primarily men, but including some women, were gathered around him, asking questions about the techniques of making spear throwers and the lightweight spears that had proved to be so effective with it. Across the hearth, near the wall that helped contain the heat, several women who had babies, Ayla among them, were gathered together feeding, rocking, or keeping an eye on sleeping ones while they chatted. In a separate, more isolated area of the shelter, Zelandani, who was first, had been talking with the other Zelandania and their acolytes, feeling just a little annoyed that Ayla, who was her acolyte, had not joined them. She knew she had pushed her into it, but Ayla was already an accomplished healer when she had arrived and had other remarkable skills besides, including knowing how to control animals. She belonged in the Zelandania. The Zelandani of the seventh had asked the first a question and was waiting for an answer with a patient expression. He had noticed that the Zelandani of the ninth cave seemed distracted and a bit annoyed. He had been observing her since the visitors arrived and had seen her irritation grow and guessed why. When Zelandania visited each other with their acolytes, it was a good time to teach the novices some of the knowledge and lore they had to learn and memorize, and her acolyte was not here. But, he thought, if the first was going to choose an acolyte who had a mate and a new baby, she had to know her full attention would not be devoted to the Zelandania.
"Excuse me for a moment," the first said,
pulling herself up from a mat on a low stone ledge and walking toward the group of chattering young mothers.
"Ayla?"
she said, smiling. She was adept at hiding her true feelings.
"I'm sorry to interrupt, but the Zelandani of the Seventh Cave just asked me a question about setting broken bones, and I thought you might have some thoughts to contribute."
"Of course, Zelandani," she said. "Let me get Janela. She's right over there."
Ayla got up, but hesitated when she looked down at her sleeping baby. Wolf looked up at her and whined, beating his tail against the ground. He was lying beside the infant that he considered to be his special charge. Wolf had been the last of the litter of a lone wolf that Ayla had killed for stealing from her traps, before she knew it was a nursing mother. She tracked back to the den, found one living cub, and brought him back with her. He had grown up in the close confines of the Mamutoi winter dwelling. He was so young when she found him, he would have counted perhaps 4 weeks, that he had imprinted on humans, and he adored the youngsters, especially the young one born to Ayla.
"I hate to disturb her. She just fell asleep. She's not used to visiting and has been overexcited this evening," Ayla said.
"We can watch her," Lavila said, then grinned.
"At least help Wolf. He won't let her out of his sight. If she wakes, we'll bring her over. But now that she's finally settled down, I don't think she'll stir for some time."
"Thank you, Lavila," Ayla said, then smiled at her and the woman beside her.
"You really are Proliva's sister. Do you know how much you are like her?"
"I know I've missed her since she mated Joharan," Lavila said, looking at her sister. "We were always close. Proliva was almost a second mother to me."
Ayla followed the one who was first back to the group of those who served the mother. She noticed that most of the local Zelandania were there, in addition to the first, who was the Zelandani of the Ninth Cave, and of course the Zelandania of the Second and Seventh Caves. There were also the Zelandania of the Third and Eleventh Caves. The Zelandani of the 14th had not come, but she had sent her first acolyte. There were several other acolytes. Ayla recognized the two younger women and a young man from the Second and Seventh Caves. She smiled at Majera from the Third Cave and greeted the elderly man who was the Zelandani of the Seventh, and then the woman who was the daughter of his hearth, the Zelandani of the Second, who was also the mother of Jondakam. Ayla had been wanting to get to know the Second better. Not many of the Zelandania had children, but she was a woman who had been mated and had raised two children and her brother Kimaran after their mother died, and now was a Zelandani.
"Ayla has had more experience than most in setting bones, Zelandani of the Seventh. You should ask her your question," the first said, settling back down and indicating a mat next to her for Ayla.
"I know if a fresh break is set straight, it will heal straight. I've done it many times. But someone was asking me if anything could be done if a break was not set straight and it healed crooked," the older man asked immediately. He was not only interested in her response, he had heard so much about her skill from the one who was first, he wanted to see if she would be flustered by a direct question from someone of his age and experience. Ayla had just dropped down to the mat and turned to face him. She had a way of lowering herself that was particularly fluid and graceful, he noticed, and a way of looking at him that was direct, yet not quite, that somehow conveyed a sense of respect. Though she had expected to be formally introduced to the other acolytes and was surprised to be questioned so quickly, she responded without hesitation.
"It depends on the break and how long it has been healing," Ayla said. "If it's an old break, it's hard to do much. Healed bone, even if it healed wrong, is often stronger than bone that was not injured. If you try to re-break it to set it right, the uninjured bone is likely to break instead. But if the break has just started to mend, sometimes it can be broken again and set straight."
"Have you ever done it?" the seventh asked,
a bit put off by the way she spoke. It was odd, not like the way Kimmeran's pretty mate spoke, with a rather pleasant shift in certain sounds. When Jondalar's foreign woman spoke, it was almost as though she swallowed certain sounds.
Yes,
Ayla said. She had the feeling she was being tested, something like the way Issa used to ask her questions about healing practices and plant uses.
On our journey here, we stopped to visit some people that Jondalar had met earlier, the Sharamudoi. Nearly a moon before we arrived, a woman he knew took a bad fall and broke her arm. It was healing wrong, bent in such a way that she couldn't use it, and it was very painful. Their healer had died earlier that winter, and they did not have a new one yet, and no one else knew how to set an arm. I managed to re-break her arm and reset it. It was not perfect, but it was better. She would not have full use, but she would be able to use it, and by the time we left, it was healing well and not causing her pain anymore,
Ayla explained. Didn't breaking her arm cause her pain? A young man asked.
I don't think she felt the pain. I gave her something to make her sleep and relax her muscles. I know it as Datura.
Datura? The old man interrupted. Her accent was particularly heavy when she said the word.
In Mamutoi, it's called a word that might mean thorn apple in Zelandani, because at one stage it bears a fruit that could be described that way. It's a strong-smelling, large plant with big white flowers that flare out from the stem, Ayla said.
Yes, I believe I know the one, the old Zelandani of the Seventh Cave said.
How did you know what to do?
Asked the young woman who was sitting beside the old man, in a tone that sounded full of wonder that someone who was just an acolyte could have known so much.
Yes, that is a good question, the seventh said. How did you know what to do? Where did you get your experience? You seem quite knowledgeable for one so young.
Ayla glanced at the first, who seemed rather pleased. She wasn't sure why, but she had the impression that the woman was satisfied by her recitation.
The woman who took me in and raised me when I was a little girl was a medicine woman of her people, a healer. She was training me to be a medicine woman, too. Men of the clan use a different kind of spear than Zelandanyi men when they hunt. It's longer and thicker. And they don't usually throw it, they jab with it, so they have to get close. It's more dangerous, and they were often hurt. Sometimes the hunters of the clan traveled quite a long distance. If someone broke a bone, they weren't always able to return right away, and the bone would start to heal before it could be set. I assisted Issa a few times when she had to re-break and reset bones, and I also helped the medicine women at the clan gathering do the same.
These people you call the clan, are they really the same as Flatheads?
The young man asked. She had been asked that question before, and she thought by the same young man.
That is your word for them?
Ayla said again.
It's hard to believe they could do so much, he said.
Not for me. I lived with them.
There was an uncomfortable silence for a few moments. Then the first changed the subject.
I think this would be a good time for the acolytes to learn, or for some of you, to review counting words, some of their uses and meanings. You all know the counting words, but what can you do if there are large amounts to count? Zelandani of the Second Cave, would you explain?
Ayla's interest was quickened. Suddenly fascinated, she leaned forward. She knew counting could be more complex and powerful than just the simple counting words, if one understood how to do it. The first noted her attention with satisfaction. She was sure that Ayla had a particular curiosity about the concept of counting.
You can use your hands, the second said, and held up both hands. With the right hand, you count on your fingers as each word is said, up to five.
She made a fist, and lifted each finger in turn as she counted, beginning with the thumb. You can count another 5 on your left hand until you get to 10, but that is as far as you can go with just counting. But instead of using the left hand to count the second 5, you can bend down one finger, the thumb, to hold the first 5. She held up her left hand with the back facing out. Then count again on the right hand and bend down the second counting finger of the left hand to hold it. She bent her index finger on top of her thumb so that she was holding open both hands except for the index finger and thumb of her left hand. That means 10, she said. If I hold down the next finger, that means 15. The next finger is 20, and the next one, 25.
Ayla was amazed. She comprehended the idea immediately, though it was more complex than the simple counting words Jandalar had taught her. She remembered the first time she learned the concept of calculating the number of things. It was Kreb, the Mogur of the clan, who had shown her, but essentially he could only count to 10. The first time he showed her his way of counting, when she was still a girl, he placed each finger of one hand on 5 different stones, and then, since one arm had been amputated below the elbow, he did it a second time, imagining that it was his other hand. With great difficulty, he could stretch his imagination to count to 20, which was why it had shocked and upset him when she had counted to 25 with ease. She didn't use words, the way Jandalar did. She did it with pebbles, showing Kreb 25 by placing her 5 fingers on different stones 5 times. Kreb had struggled to learn to count, but she understood the concept with ease. He told her never to tell anyone what she had done. He knew she was different from the clan, but he hadn't understood how different until then, and he knew it would distress them, especially Brun and the men, perhaps enough to drive her out. Most of the clan could count only 1, 2, 3, and many, though they could indicate some gradations of many, and they had other ways of understanding quantities. For example, they didn't have counting words for the years of a child's life, but they knew that a child in his birthing year was younger than a child who was in his walking year or his weaning year. It was also true that Brun didn't have to count the people of his clan. He knew the name of everyone, and with just a quick glance he knew if someone was not there and who it was. Most people shared that ability to some degree. Once they were with a limited number of people for a period of time, they intuitively sensed if someone was missing. Ayla knew that if her understanding of counting upset Kreb, who loved her, it would disturb the rest of the clan even more, so she never mentioned it, but she hadn't forgotten. She used her limited knowledge of counting for herself, especially when she lived alone in the valley. She had marked the passing of time by cutting marks on a stick every day. She knew how many seasons and years she had lived in the valley, even without having counting words. But when Jandalar came, he was able to tally the marks on her sticks and tell her how long she had been there. To her, it was like magic. Now that she had an idea how he had done it, she was hungry to learn more. There are ways to count even higher, but it is more complicated, the second continued, then smiled. As with most things associated with the Zelindania, those watching smiled back. Most signs have more than one meaning. Both hands can mean 10 or 25, and it's not hard to understand what is meant when you are talking about it, because when you mean 10, you face the palms out. When you mean 25, you turn the palms inward. When you hold them facing in, you can count again, but this time use the left hand and hold the number with the right. She demonstrated, and the acolytes mimicked her. In that position, bending down the thumb means 30. But when you count and hold to 35, you don't hold the thumb down. You just bend the next finger down. For 40, you bend down the middle finger.
For 45, the next, and for 50, the small finger of the right hand is bent, and all the other fingers on both hands are out. The right hand with bent fingers are sometimes used alone to show those larger counting words. Even larger counting words can be made bending more than one finger. Ayla had trouble bending just her little finger and holding that position. It was obvious that the rest of them had more practice, but she had no trouble understanding. The first saw Ayla grinning with amazement and delight and nodded to herself. This is the way to keep her involved, she thought. A handprint can be made on a surface, like a piece of wood, or the wall of a cave, even on the bank of a stream, the first added. That hand sign can mean several different things. It may mean counting words, but it may mean something else entirely. If you want to leave a handprint sign, you can dip your palm in color and leave the mark, or you can place your hand on the surface and blow color on and around the back of it, which leaves a different kind of handprint. If you want to make a sign that means a counting word, dip the palm in color for the smaller ones and blow color on the back of your hand to show the larger ones. One cave to the south and east of here makes the sign of a large dot, using color on only the palm, without showing the fingers. Ayla's mind was racing, overwhelmed with the idea of counting. Kreb, the greatest Mogur of the clan, could, with great effort, count to 20. She could count to 25 and represent it with just two hands in a way that others could understand it, and then increase that number. You could tell someone how many red deer had congregated at their spring calving grounds, how many young were born, a small number like 5, a small group, 25, or many more than that. It would be harder to count a large herd, but it could all be communicated. How much meat should be stored to last how many people through the winter? How many strings of dried roots? How many baskets of nuts? How many days will it take to reach the summer meeting place? How many people will be there? The possibilities were incredible. Counting words had tremendous significance, both real and symbolic. The one who was first was talking again, and Ayla had to wrench her mind away from her contemplations. She was holding up one hand. The number of fingers on one hand, 5, is an important counting word in its own right. It represents the number of fingers on each hand and the toes on each foot, of course, but that is only its superficial meaning. 5 is also the mother's sacred counting word. Our hands and feet only remind us of that. Another thing that reminds us of that is the apple. She produced a small, unripe, hard apple and held it up. If you hold an apple on its side and cut it in half, as if you were cutting through the stem within the fruit, she demonstrated as she spoke, you will see that the pattern of the seeds divides the apple into 5 sections. That is why the apple is the mother's sacred fruit. She passed out both sections to be examined by the acolytes, giving the top half to Ayla. There are other important aspects of the counting word 5. As you will learn, you can see 5 stars in the sky that move in a random pattern each year. And there are 5 seasons of the year, spring, summer, autumn, and the 2 cold periods, early winter and late winter. Most people think the year starts with spring, when new green starts growing, but the Zelandania know that the beginning of the year is marked by the winter short day, which is what divides early winter from late winter. The true year begins with late winter, then spring, summer, autumn, and early winter.
The Mamutoi count 5 seasons too, Ayla volunteered. Actually, 3 major seasons, spring, summer, and winter, and 2 minor seasons, fall and midwinter. Perhaps it should be called late winter.
Some of the others were rather surprised that she would interject a comment when the first was explaining a basic concept, but the first smiled inwardly, pleased to see her getting involved.
They consider three to be a primary counting word because it represents woman, like the three-sided triangle with the point facing down represents woman and the Great Mother. When they add the two others, fall and midwinter, seasons that mean changes are coming, it makes five. Mammut said five was her counting word of hidden authority.
That's very interesting, Ayla. We say five is her sacred counting word. We also consider three to be an important concept for similar reasons. I'd like to hear more about the people you call the Mammutoi and their customs. Perhaps the next time the Zelandania meet, the first said. Ayla was listening with fascination. The first had a voice that captured attention, demanded it, when she chose to focus it. But it wasn't only the voice. The knowledge and information she was imparting were stimulating and absorbing. Ayla wanted to know more. There are also five sacred colors and five sacred elements. But it's getting late, and we'll get into that next time, said the one who was first among those who served the Great Earth Mother. Ayla felt disappointed. She could have listened all night. But then she looked up and saw Falara coming with John Ayla. Her baby was awake. Chapter 4 Anticipation for the summer meeting intensified after the ninth cave returned from visiting the seventh and second caves. Everyone's time and attention was occupied with the hectic rush of getting ready to leave, and the excitement was palpable. Each family was busy with its own preparations, but the various leaders had the additional duty of planning and organizing for their entire cave. That they were willing to assume the responsibility and able to carry it out was why they were leaders. The leaders of all the Zelandanyi caves were anxious before a summer meeting, but Joharan was especially so. While most caves tended to have some 25 to 50 people, some as much as 70 or 80, usually related, his cave was an exception. Nearly 200 individuals belonged to the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi. It was a challenge to lead so many people, but Joharan was up to the task. Not only had Joharan's mother, Marthona, been a leader of the ninth cave, but Jokonan, the first man to whom she was mated and to whose hearth Joharan had been born, was the leader before her. Joharan's brother, Jondalar, who was born to the hearth of Dalinar, the man Marthona mated after Jokonan died, had specialized in a craft in which he showed both skill and inclination. Like Dalinar, he was recognized as an expert flint napper because it was what he did best. But Joharan grew up immersed in the ways of leadership and had a natural propensity to take on those responsibilities. It was what he did best. The Zelandanyi had no formal process for selecting leaders, but as people lived together, they learned who the best person was to help them to resolve a conflict or sort out a problem. And they tended to follow the ones who took on the organization of an activity and did it well. If several people decided to go hunting, for example, it wasn't necessarily the best hunter they chose to follow, but the one who could direct the group in a way that made the hunt most successful for everyone. Often, though not always, the best problem solver was also the best organizer. Sometimes two or three people who were known for their specific areas of expertise worked together. After a while, the one who dealt with conflicts and managed activities most effectively was acknowledged as the leader, not in any kind of structured way, but by unspoken consent. Those who obtained leadership positions gained status, but such leaders governed by persuasion and influence, they had no coercive power. There were no specific rules or laws requiring compliance or means of enforcing them, which made leadership more difficult. But peer pressure to acknowledge and accept suggestions by the head of the cave was strong. The spiritual leaders, the Zelandania, had even less authority to compel, but perhaps more power to persuade. They were greatly respected and a little feared. Their knowledge of the unknown and their familiarity with the terrifying world of the spirits, which was an important element in the lives of the community, commanded respect. Ayla's excitement about the upcoming summer meeting increased as the time to leave approached. She hadn't noticed it as much the previous year, but they had arrived at Jondalar's home not long before the annual gathering of the Zelandanyi after traveling for a year, and she had felt excitement and tension enough just meeting his people and getting accustomed to their ways. This year she had been aware of her mounting enthusiasm since the beginning of spring, and as the days passed, she was as rushed and eager as everyone. It was a lot of work to get ready for the summer, especially knowing that they would be traveling around, not staying at any single place for the whole season. The summer meeting was where people gathered together after the long cold season to reaffirm their ties, to find mates, and to exchange goods and news. The location became a sort of base camp from which individuals and smaller groups would be going on hunting expeditions and gathering excursions, exploring their land to see what had changed, and visiting additional caves to see other friends and kin, and some more distant neighbors. Summer was the itinerant season. The Zelandanyi were essentially sedentary only in winter. Ayla had finished changing and nursing John Ayla and put her down to sleep. Wolf had gone out earlier, probably to hunt or explore. She had just spread out their traveling sleeping roll to see what repairs it might need when she heard a tapping on the post beside the drape that closed the entrance to their dwelling. Her home was located near the back of the protected space, but closer to the southwestern, downriver end of the living area, since it was one of the newer constructions. She got up and pulled aside the drape and was pleased to see the one who was first standing there.
"How nice to see you, Zelandani," she said, smiling. "Come in."
After the woman entered, Ayla caught a sense of movement outside and glanced up at another construction that she and Jondalar had made somewhat farther on across the vacant space as a place for the horses to shelter when the weather was especially disagreeable. She noticed that Winnie and Gray had just come up from the grassy edge of the river.
"I was going to make some tea for myself. Can I make some for you?"
"Thank you, yes," the large woman said, as she headed for a block of limestone with a large cushion on top that had been brought inside, especially for her to use as a seat. It was sturdy and comfortable. Ayla busied herself, placing some cooking stones on the hot coals she had stirred up in the fireplace and adding more wood. Then she poured water from the water bag, the clean stomach of an aurochs bulging with fullness, into a tightly woven basket, and added some broken pieces of bone to protect the cooking basket from the sizzling hot cooking stones.
"Is there a particular tea you'd like?" she asked.
"It doesn't matter. You choose. Something calming would be nice," Zelandani replied. The padded rock had appeared in their dwelling shortly after they returned from the summer meeting the year before. The first had not asked for it, and she wasn't sure whether it was Ayla's idea or Jondalar's, but she knew it was meant for her, and she appreciated it. Zelandani had two stone seats of her own, one in her dwelling and one near the back of the exterior common work area. In addition, Joharan and Proliva provided her a solid place to sit comfortably in their dwelling. Though she could still get down on the floor if it was necessary, as time went on and she continued to grow fatter, she was finding it harder to get up. She assumed that since she was chosen to be first by the Great Earth Mother,
she had a reason for making her look more like her every year. Not every Zelandani who had become first was fat, but she knew most people liked seeing her that way. Her size seemed to lend presence and authority. A little less mobility was a small price to pay. With wooden tongs, Ayla picked up a hot stone. The tongs were made from a thin piece of wood from just under the bark of a living tree, peeled in a long strip, the top and bottom cut, then bent around with steam. Fresh wood kept its springiness longer, but to keep the tree from dying, it was best if taken from only one side. She tapped the cooking stone against one of the rocks that circled the fire pit to shake off the ashes, then dropped it into the water amid a cloud of steam. A second hot stone brought the water to the boil, though it settled down quickly. The pieces of bone kept the hot rocks from scorching the bottom of the basket, giving the fiber cooking pot a longer life. Ayla looked through her supply of dried and drying herbs. Chamomile was always calming, but it was so commonplace. She wanted something more. She noticed a plant she had picked recently and smiled to herself. The lemon balm wasn't entirely dry yet, but she decided it didn't matter. It was entirely usable for tea. A little added to the chamomile along with some linden for a bit of sweetening would make a nice calming infusion. She put the chamomile leaves, the lemon balm, and linden into the water and let it steep a while, then poured two cups and brought one to the danyer. The woman blew on it a bit, then sipped it carefully and cocked her head, trying to identify the taste.
Chamomile, of course, but let me think. Is it lemon balm with perhaps some linden flowers? She asked.
Ayla smiled. It was exactly what she did when she was given something unknown. She tried to identify it. And of course Zelandani had known the ingredients.
Yes, Ayla said. I had dried chamomile and linden flowers, but I just found the lemon balm a few days ago. I'm glad it grows nearby.
Perhaps you could collect some lemon balm for me the next time you get some for yourself. It could be useful to take to the summer meeting.
I'd be happy to. I could even get it today. I know exactly where it grows, on the plateau above, near the falling stone, she said.
Ayla was referring to the unique formation of an ancient columnar section of basalt that had once found its way to the bottom of the primordial sea and was now eroding out of the limestone in a way that made it appear to be falling, though it was still firmly embedded into the upper face of the cliff.
What do you know about the uses of this? Zelandani asked, holding up the cup of tea.
Chamomile is relaxing, and if you take it at night, it can help you to fall asleep. Lemon balm is calming, especially if you feel nervous and stressful. It will even relieve the stomach upset that sometimes comes with stress, and it will help you sleep. It has a pleasant taste that is good with chamomile. Linden helps with headaches, especially when you feel tight and tense, and adds a little sweetening.
Ayla thought of Issa and the way she would test her with similar questions to see how much she remembered of the knowledge Issa was teaching her. She wondered if Zelandani was also trying to find out how much she knew.
Yes, this tea could be used as a mild sedative in sufficient strength.
If someone is really excitable, anxious, and can't sleep, and something a little stronger is needed, the liquid from boiled valerian roots is settling, Ayla said,
particularly at night to bring on sleep. But if the stomach is also upset, then vervain, a tea of the flower stems and leaves, may be better, the first said.
I've also used vervain for someone recovering from a long illness, but it should not be given to a pregnant woman. It can stimulate labor and even milk flow.
The two women stopped, looked at each other, and chuckled. Then Ayla said,
I can't tell you how happy it makes me to have someone to talk to about medicines and healing. Someone who knows so much.
I think you may know as much as I do, in certain ways more, Ayla. And